Welcome back to Season 3. This season we'll be looking at a new aspect of sustainability, the healthcare sector. And so, our season title is A Manifesto for Surgical Health in Africa. I have invited Professor Bruce Bickard to host this season, the first time Earthcast will be hosted by someone other than myself. Bruce will unpack his new book through interviews with African and global experts in the field who helped him write it.
Good evening, everyone. It's my pleasure today to be hosting this podcast with John Mira and Emmanuel Makasa. John Mira is founder and director emeritus of the Program in Global Surgery and Social Change in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine. He is professor of surgery in the field of pediatric plastic surgery at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Medical Staff Executive Committee at Boston Children's Hospital. He was co-chair of the Lancet Commission on Global Surgery. Emmanuel Makasa is adjunct professor of global surgery, a public health epidemiologist, and an orthopedic and trauma surgeon. He is the founding director of the Southern African Development Communities, University of the Witwatersrand-based Regional Hub, and Collaboration Center for Surgical Healthcare Improvement. And it spoke the Center for Surgical Healthcare Research in Zambia. He chairs the regional SADC Technical Experts Working Group on Surgical Healthcare, and he's a strong advocate for health systems strengthening through improved surgical healthcare. John and Emmanuel, thank you for joining me and for sharing your time with us. Just to recap, what we've discussed previously in the podcast have been on the current state of surgical outcomes in Africa and a proposed model to improve the quality of care from within our hospital. But the reality is that even if we can improve the care from within a hospital, the care that surgical patients can receive is essentially capped by the resources which are available. The two of you feature heavily in this part of the book due to the large part you've played in this space. So thank you. And to give the listeners some context, I'd just like to read a short paragraph from the book, so that they can understand the implications of limited resources. And so this is a short paragraph, and it goes like this. In Africa, sedation has been used to increase access to surgery, but patients receiving procedural sedation by non-physicians in Africa has an eightfold increase in the odds of severe complications or death compared to that administered by physicians. This finding is even more important when one considers that nearly a third of all sedations for surgery in Africa are provided by non-physicians. This is naturally an extremely sensitive issue, and on submitting the data for publication, we worked hard with a statistical editor to ensure that the signal of harm associated with the provision of sedation for surgery by non-physicians was real and robust. This is important, because it's easy to jump to a conclusion that it is the non-physicians alone that are responsible for these poor outcomes. What we found, however, was that the non-physicians were working in an environment which was significantly more resource constrained than that of the physicians. It was as if their hands had been tied and they were forced to do something to enable surgery, which in these cases was to provide sedation to enable surgery, where general anesthesia was not available. These resource-limited environments almost certainly were driving the bad outcomes and not the non-physicians themselves. So, John, as the co-lead for the Lancet Commission for Global Surgery and the development of the National Surgical Obstetric and Anesthesia Program, or ENSO program, can you tell us basically what your feeling is on the implementation progress so far? I mean, the whole objective of the ENSO program is to create the environment which has the capacity to provide safe anesthesia and surgery.
Well, Bruce, first, thank you for inviting me. It's really an honor to be able to speak with you. You know, let me make a few comments before I get to answer your question, actually, because I was struck by reading your book. You know, I'll tell you that the fall in the U.S. is busy with holidays and whatnot. And so I hadn't actually read your book until yesterday. And I, you know, when you emailed me, I opened it up and started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. It's really exceptional. And you did a wonderful job of weaving in, you know, true stories with, you know, academic research and really distilling down some incredible points. And, you know, one of the things you talked about was that resources in general have to come before processes. And so you just read a passage there that, you know, that statement is pertinent to, because you have, you know, these poor people, the non-physicians who are trying to provide care, but they don't have the adequate resources. So, you know, it really doesn't matter what the processes are. They're hampered by not having what they need to have. And related to this, I was also, it was fascinating to read about the surgical safety checklist and how the uptake increases in countries of higher economic output. And that also is highly related, because you have these people who they realize that, you know, going through that surgical safety checklist, it's really almost a farce. If they don't have the right antibiotics, if they don't have the right instruments, then why go through that checklist? It only highlights the fact that they don't have what they need. It doesn't allow them to get what they need. So really had, and that's just to name a few of the insights in your book. I thought you did a wonderful job at that. But in terms of answering your question specifically of what's happened since the Lancet Commission, I would categorize it in a couple ways. So the whole concept of a national surgical obstetric and anesthesia plan is a strategic planning exercise. And so when you look prior to, you know, 2015, there weren't any countries who had done that type of a holistic strategic plan. And as you mentioned in your book, Emmanuel Mukasa was one of the leaders who started the first NSOAP, if you will, the first national surgical obstetric and anesthesia strategic plan in his country. And it's interesting to watch what's happened after that. So to summarize things quickly, you saw the Southern African Development Community come together and pass their own resolution that advocated that all of the SADC countries should have a national surgical obstetric and anesthesia strategic plan. And I think, you know, partly because of that leadership, it spread outside of Africa. So the surgical leaders in the Pacific Islands, for example, witnessed what was happening, and they started to begin a process of their own. And that spread to the Western Pacific Regional Office. So in 2018 or 2019, the WIPRO annual meeting included surgery as part of its agenda. So I guess my point is, you see one leader, in this case, Emmanuel, who begins a process in Zambia that then leads to a broader regional process in the Southern African Development Community. And then it spreads to the Pacific Islands and then to Pakistan with Lubna Samad. And more recently, just to bring you right up to the recent time, Vice President Barrero from Ecuador, he's a neurosurgeon, and he was vice president up until actually last month. He led a process in Ecuador to create a national surgical obstetric and anesthesia plan in Ecuador. So one of the things I've seen is that specific leaders have identified the importance of national level planning and led this process. So that's certainly a positive thing. And as you pointed out in your book, there was no such thing before that, and certainly before Emmanuel had started that process. The other thing that I've been happy to see is just the narrative around surgery has changed. So, you know, Bruce, you and I remember prior to 2015, you know, going back to even 2010, no one was talking about surgery. So at the WHA meetings in Geneva, no one was talking about surgery. There are no surgery side events. You know, the World Health Summit in Berlin, nobody was talking about surgery. There were no side events there. At UNGA, there were no discussion of surgery, certainly no side events there. So, you know, and I remember all of us, we were frustrated that, you know, why is no one talking about this? And so I guess I like what I've seen in that regard, in that now every year at WHA, there are side events, and in fact, several. In Berlin at the World Health Summit, there are side events. UNGA at the WIPRO meeting, as I mentioned, SADC is actively involved. In fact, there's a working group that they have a big WhatsApp group, and they meet quite regularly, and you're involved in that process. So the narrative has completely changed. So in that regard, Bruce, I feel like, you know, countries have witness the importance of this. They're actually acting on this. And even beyond that, the whole global narrative has changed so that now at least we're in the discourse in these major events.
Thanks, John. Yes, I agree completely. It is very encouraging to see how the surgical narrative has increased and our understanding of its importance to public health. And certainly, you know, when Richard Horton had to address the World Health Assembly and he asked the global community what were the five most important things that should be addressed at the assembly, the one was surgery, and the other, interestingly, was the climate. So two very important things, which actually we will touch on in this podcast today, obviously. So, you know, despite the success of the narrative and the understanding for delivering safe surgery, what do you think at the moment are barriers to achieving these objectives, especially from the NSOAP implementation?
Well, you know, that was the other half of what I was going to get to in terms of maybe areas for improvement. You know, I commented on some of the things that I saw positive that have come out of this work. But before I get to that, I do want to comment on Richard Horton's speech at WHA. You know, who would have conceived that that was possible, you know, prior to 2015? I mean, if you had asked someone and said, will someone like Richard Horton give a major speech at the World Health Assembly meeting and discuss surgery, that was completely inconceivable. So I agree with you. I thought that was just an enormous change. You know, in terms of answering your question directly, you're asking what areas for improvement are there? You know, we talked about the successes, but where do we need to work now? You know, I think, I know Emmanuel Mikasa will have some on the ground ideas in terms of, you know, his work both in Zambia and with the whole SADC region. But I think implementation has been very difficult. So if you look at the countries, there are many countries that have created a strategic plan for surgery and anesthesia and OB, but to what degree has it been implemented? So I think that's a question in my mind. Funding is the other area. So, you know, we haven't seen changes in funding streams. So has the World Bank changed the way it funds healthcare to include surgery? No, it hasn't. Has the Gates Foundation? Has the African Development Bank? We haven't seen huge changes in funding streams. And I think it's necessary. You mentioned in your book the fact that funding isn't following disease burden. And I think that's a very important point. There should be some logic to how funding should follow disease burden. And I think the third area that I'd like to see more of is in evaluation. So countries that have a strategy, it would be nice to see an evaluation of what impact that has had in all of the six domains of the strategic plan.
Emmanuel, I'd just like to ask you, you were part of the original group who promoted the signing of the WHA Resolution 68.15, where countries committed to delivery of safe anesthesia and surgery. And then you went on to start the first NSOAP process in your country, in Zambia, which John Muir has alluded to already. Can you tell listeners what you believe is needed to deliver an NSOAP program in a resource-limited country so that everyone can have access to safe surgery? I mean, how did you, you know, initiate this process in Zambia?
Okay, thank you so much, Bruce. The process in Zambia obviously starts before the resolution in 6815, based on the experiences we had. And I happened to be part of the senior management within the Ministry of Health, and I was tasked with the responsibility of setting up emergency health services, and also I was involved in training. So the ministry already knew that our surgical services were not really the best. They didn't have like scientifically proven data, but one, they already knew that they didn't have enough data at ministerial level as regards the surgical systems or the burden of surgical disease. But we knew from experience, having worked at that level and also having been clinicians ourselves, that access to surgery was only available in the big cities. Even there, it was only limited to a few. Most of the peri-urban, in fact, we had a lot of waiting lines, or, you know, people waiting to access surgery. And the surgery we were providing was not of the best standard. It was not safe. And then when you go further down to the districts or the rural areas, the situation was bad in that there was access to surgery was not totally non-existent. Now, this is really why the ministry was keen or agreed when we asked them, when I was working as a diplomat in Geneva, if we could come up with a resolution. Because first of all, we knew that engaging with the WHO country office, there was nothing there in terms of policy or guidelines that they could help us with. There was also nothing at the regional level. And when we got to the global stage, within the WHO, there was only one person with the program that was ad hoc, funded by countries themselves. And there was no public health agreement or commitment by the member states themselves to develop this area. And yet we knew from clinical practice and from the study of medicine that surgery is a cornerstone of medicine. Surgery is the cornerstone of delivery of healthcare. And so if it's neglected, we didn't see how universal health coverage was ever going to be achieved within our country or anywhere else for that matter. So this was the background to which we pushed the agenda of having that resolution. And those are the things that we used to negotiate with other member states. And it's true, all of them agreed very quickly because they knew what we were talking about. Now, again, like you clearly say, it's one thing to have political commitments in a multilateral intergovernmental platform like the UN, and it's another to actually follow through with those commitments and deliver the care that's required. So we got the commitment, but we didn't know how to do it. How are we going to translate it into anything tangible? And that's why the Lancet Commission's work was very handy for us. They had mapped out scientifically the burden of disease. They had provided guidelines in terms of a framework that we could use to start developing national surgical healthcare policy, which the UN did not have, which WHO did not have. And they had also influenced, I think, the work of the World Bank on justifying why we should invest in surgical disease in terms of costs, cost effectiveness, and potentially the procedures that could be done. They had also provided with some indicators of what we can use to track what we're doing, the surgical volume, the density of health workers, and other things. So all this, therefore, was good for us to try and work with, to try and do something on the ground. And so that's why quickly we tried to do what we wanted to do on the ground. But it also took having the right people in the right place. Because, many countries have committed and agreed that there's need to improve surgical care as a way of strengthening health systems or delivering better health outcomes. And of course, even putting the population on a better socioeconomic path to recovery or to development. But it also requires to have the right people in the right time, because it takes time to actually translate policy into action in terms of service delivery. It must be translated into a national healthcare policy, which must be integrated. And then, again, even with integration, like you said, with the Zambian National Surgical Plan, the first one from 2017 to 2021, we didn't really implement because there was no buy-in from the frontline stakeholders that actually must implement. It remained a document that was at national level in the Ministry of Health headquarters. Very little was done within the provinces and within the districts because everybody continued to work like they've always worked before. First of all, we didn't do a very good way of disseminating it or indeed decentralizing it, because the budgeting process that we talk about, John talked about the funding. Funding primarily, first of all, should come. It's not just having the policy. You must have the budget lines. But where does the money come from? The budget lines are not from top down. Yes, we know there is that influence. But the budget lines that come from top down are earmarked. And usually governments do not earmark any funds. It's the partners, the donors that earmark their funds, saying, my money as Gates Foundation should go only to malaria prevention, nothing else. The money that comes from government is down, is bottom up, because the budget of what we're going to spend on at a facility level or at district level or at provincial level is decided there. We feed then into the national budget of the Ministry of Health, which then feeds into the budget of the Ministry of Finance. So without the bottom line or the bottom level facilities deciding that, making first of all their own mini assessment to understand what do they have and what don't they have? What is their priority? What are they going to attain in year one, year two, year three, year four? If they don't do that, then nothing really happens. Then there'll be no budget lines. And we didn't do that in Zambia. And so we never got any earmarked or kind of, ring-fenced monies starting from the facility going up. And so implementation was impossible with that kind of support. And it's not just financial resources. Even other resources must be budgeted and must be aligned and must be, earmarked or ring-fenced. The human resource. Well, if you need surgeons or surgery to take place at the district, you may need surgeons. Do you have them? Where are you going to get them? You may have medical officers that you may improve, whose training you can improve, but that takes you to invest in that kind of thing as a district to do that. And so the buy-in was difficult, the dissemination was difficult, the alignment was there, the integration was there, but it was very high level. It was not lower level. And obviously in the future and in many other countries where we are going to, we must not only have a national plan, that plan must be decentralized down to the facility level. The facility must have a plan. The district must have a plan. That all feeds into the bigger picture. Because like I say, these are important for budgeting, these are important for resource allocation and actually moving forward. And also a strong commitment to ensuring that we are tracking, because we can't just be investing without knowing where we're putting the money. We must account for this money. We must measure the impact of this investment. If we're not providing any data, obviously there'll be no data at the decision level. And if they have no data, they'll throw the whole thing away because it's just a hearsay. It's just people making noise. We must argue with statistics. If we don't argue with information, real data that we have, then of course that also is a problem. And we haven't done that. In the Zambian NSOP, yes, we did have a national plan, but there was no input from the ground of what was the surgical volume at University Teaching Hospital in Lusaka province. We didn't have that data. Even right now, it's not there. So the data system must be in place to justify the impact of the investment and also to measure the progress we are making and to assess the gaps we still have and to also learn lessons. What is really working better? What can we do better? What can we scale up? And things like that. And so there are all these different components, and I can go on. I don't want to go on forever, to talk about this. Yeah, maybe I leave you to ask specific questions and then we can answer them.
Emmanuel, I think you've summarized this well. And I think, the way you've taken the conversation actually leads nicely to what will be the next podcast, because, a lot of what you speak about is for something to be successful requires advocacy. It comes down to communication, ensuring people understand that the population and a civil society demand an environment which allows them to experience safe anesthesia and surgery. You're correct in that, the Lancet Commission provided us with so much data to support that. But I feel where we're failing is that society doesn't realize, that there's a lot of surgery that is not happening that should happen. And in places like Africa, unfortunately, the quality of surgery or the outcomes is poor, and partly because of what we're discussing today, because there's a lack of resources. I want to move on to what would be almost the last question for this podcast. But, when we look at surgical resources and how limited they are in Africa, and then we go back to, John, what we discussed earlier with the Lancet's 5 points to discuss at WHA, and climate change was one of them, was surgery. There's an opportunity now, because one of the concerns always is that surgery has quite an impact on the environment. But until we have a healthy population, we really can't look after the environment, because that is less of a priority than just ensuring that people are healthy. But we've got the opportunity actually in low resource environments, as we try and institute NSOPs, that we can actually make for greener surgery, because we're not shackled down with everything that exists at the moment. And I think this is a very important point. We really could make quite a positive change in also delivering better surgery. I'm just interested on your impressions, either John or Emmanuel, on this.
Hey, maybe I could try. Yes, it's true that while we are pushing the agenda of safe surgery, it's important that we already look at it with the lens of having a better environment or contributing to a better environment. In the service or the provision of safe surgery, we use a lot of tools and equipment and instruments and consumables and things like that. But we also need, for example, we can start with a bigger thing, power supply. We can't provide safe surgery without safe or sustainable and stable power supply. And when we look at the low and middle income countries, stable and sustained power supply is what they lack, which also makes the surgery unsafe. Now, these are the same countries also that usually, normally, have access to a lot of other renewables that they could use instead of relying on, you know, diesel generation, fossil fuels that are not only costly, but they're also obviously polluting the environment. We could be innovative. We know that we can access solar energy now. It may not be for the whole facility, but we know that technology and models have been developed that can provide self-surgery for the surgical spaces, the critical care space, the operating theater itself, and maintain that equipment working very well off-grid. That could be something that we bring to the table to make healthier facilities or healthier hospitals. You know, we want our hospitals to also be running off renewable energy because it's clean, it's cheaper, and it contributes to the environment so that we're not, our footprint is not so big. You know, we could do that. We could look at the how we clean our instrument and how we dispose of the medical waste, which is also incinerated. You know, that also adds to the pollution sometimes in the cities. How can we best deal with that, you know, wastage and waste materials in terms of, you know, how we dispose it off? Even just some of it is not even incinerated. Sometimes it's just gone and dumped in the communal dump sites, providing not only danger to the environment, but also to the people that always scavenge in these areas. You know, can we avoid all these disposables? Because yes, we know disposables were brought in, they are cheaper, they make things run faster, but they also contribute to the waste that we produce. In the low and middle income countries, we are used to recycling. We can recycle gowns, we can recycle, we can make them out of materials that are, you know, we can be able to recycle. So all those are things that we can discuss. And of course, there are many other areas that we can talk about that we can, you know, discuss on how we can ensure that these spaces or the surgical space and what we produce not only is safe for our patients and for the workers, but it also contributes to making sure that we have a safer environment.
So, of course, everything that Emmanuel said is right on target, and I agree with that. Let me provide a couple thoughts maybe to frame his comments. So I think the first thing that people need to realize is that healthcare is incredibly energy intensive. So 4 to 5% of the greenhouse gases globally are created by healthcare provision. And within that, surgery is really hyper intensive. So I think an operating theater is something like 6 times as energy intensive as the rest of the hospital. So, you know, number one, healthcare needs to pay attention to this. And number two, surgery certainly does, because we generate a lot of greenhouse gases and a lot of disposable waste. So number one, I think there's logic to this. Number two, when you talk about an advocacy, I think we need to realize that surgeons and anesthesiologists up until now have not really been a huge part of the climate change community. And so when you look at how advocacy works in climate change and you look at the meetings that they attend, they're different than the meetings that we go to. And so, you know, this is one of the three great issues that I think surgery needs to deal with in the future is climate change. And what I'm telling people in any lectures that I give is, we need to be part of that community. We need to bring that narrative to the climate change community. If we don't, they're not going to spontaneously start talking about it. So I think from an advocacy standpoint, we really need to do our due diligence and become as much a part of that community as possible. And the last thing I'll say is just realizing that when countries are making national strategic plans, we don't want to make really great plans from the 20th century. So I think we want these new national surgical obstetric and anesthesia plans to recognize some of the issues for the future. One of them obviously is climate change, and realize that we as surgeons and anesthesiologists have an impact on climate change, but also climate change impacts diseases and disease processes and disease frequencies. So, you know, these national strategic plans on one hand, you know, have to deal with the energy utilization and the consumption and the production. But we also in our plans have to realize how is climate change going to change the way we need to provide surgical and anesthesia care? How is it going to change the disease burden because of climate change? And so that's why I say we want strategic plans for the 21st century, not for the 20th century.
John and Emmanuel, you guys have been amazing. We're running out of time, so I'm just going to sort of finish off. Is there any question that I should have asked you that I haven't, that you think we should be discussing or should be on the table?
I just want to say that we've been working in what we are calling global surgery for some time now. It's almost 15 years. Well, it's been there before, but in a concerted effort, if we mark 2015 as the start, it's almost getting to 15 years, and we are very sick to get to the 2030. And so far, I think we've been discussing or portraying or painting surgery in our advocacy strategies and words to, you know, as a problem that needs a solution. The lack of surgical safe surgery being a problem that requires global, national, and subnational attention. And yes, we've gotten so far. We've gotten some attention. People have listened to us. Countries are making some progress. The progress is low, like you say. But the world is full of problems. And it's not a good thing for us to continue to talk about problems. And for us, some of us at country level, we've seen that the people we are talking to and presenting these problems are tired of listening to problems. I think that we can also reframe the advocacy messaging to try and portray surgery and paint it in its right frame, which is that it is a solution. Surgical services provision is a solution to many, many problems. Like you say, if we talk about the climate change and the environment, surgical services will contribute to mitigating the impact of climate change. It contributes to, you know, reducing the degradation of the environment. In fact, when there are natural disasters that are arising because of climate change, the initial response is going to be surgical. Whether there are floods, whether there are earthquakes, whether there are mudslides, when these things happen, we move in with surgical teams first before we even bring in water and sanitation. But surgery also should be framed as a solution to the challenge of the health system weaknesses that we have seen through the COVID-19 pandemic, through the Ebola outbreaks, even through wars. Sometimes little civil wars can destabilize the whole nation. Surgery is a solution. It helps strengthen the health system. We must market it. We must portray it. We must explain and scientifically prove that when you invest in surgical services that are safe and provide them 24/7 for a district, for a catchment population, you're going to strengthen your health system overall. We must prove that scientifically. We haven't done that, and we can do that. We must portray surgery as what can contribute to better health outcomes. A lot of people have poured a lot of money into different programs. People are putting money into maternal health to reduce maternal mortality. We're trying to reduce road traffic accidents and the deaths that are resulting from there. But we can't get to the zero, to the numbers we want, unless we provide what is required. And it's surgical services that will be required. For example, I can illustrate. Maternal mortality is mostly caused by bleeding, losing blood. Now, that can only be stopped with a surgical intervention, whatever the cause, whether it's a wound, a laceration, an atonic uterus, you must come and intervene and stop the bleeding. That is a surgical intervention. So the numbers have stalled. They've put in a lot of money into antenatal care, into contraceptives, a lot of other things. But nobody has really tried to improve the surgical capacity so that those that are faced with bleeding can actually be saved. Now, we must push it like that. Post-crash care of accident victims is not existent. Accident victims come to the hospitals on their own or by whatever means. When they come to us, there is nothing to use on them. So we end up losing more than we should be losing out of road traffic accidents. If you really want to get to the SDG numbers of reducing deaths on the roads, you must invest in surgical care. And then what's the whole essence of having a healthy population? We're saying surgery is part of universal health coverage, which is good health and well-being for all. What is the value of having good health and well-being? So that you can be productive, so that you can produce for yourself, for your family, for your community, for your country. And you will not do that. You will not see any development until you provide surgical care. And we can prove scientifically that if I was in a road traffic accident, I'm a breadwinner, I'm a subsistence farmer. If you can fix my bones within 3 hours, I'll get back to work within 3-6 weeks, and I'll be able to produce for myself rather than begging from my family and begging from the country or stealing from anyone. So let's frame surgery as a solution. for health system strengthening, for improving health outcomes, and indeed for putting our people on a better socioeconomic footing so they can fend for themselves and earn their own living. That is what we should use in advocacy in global surgery today. It's a different narrative from what we've been talking about as surgery being a problem that must be solved. No, it's not a problem. It is a solution for most of the things that we have today.
Thank you, Emmanuel. John, are you happy that we end there? Because I think Emmanuel summed it up beautifully, that surgery is a solution. And that's really what this is all about.
Yeah, I don't think I can say it any better. In fact, he's absolutely right. When I think back prior to 2015, you remember everyone was always complaining about the burden of disease and no one's paying attention to surgery. And he's right. It was all about the problems. And I think he's absolutely right. The only thing that I was going to add, particularly given his vision of being a solution, is just to let you know what I've been doing in a lot of my recent talks is, I alluded to the fact that I see three areas that global surgery needs to really focus on. And one of them is climate change. And we've talked about that at great length. The other is pandemic preparedness. So when you look at the last pandemic and the one before it, Ebola, surgery and anesthesia, workforce and supply chain and infrastructure have a lot to do with how we manage pandemics. And I don't want people to forget about that. And Emmanuel's absolutely right. And I think vis-a-vis pandemics, we need to say, look, this is part of the solution. You can't have climate change strategy without incorporating surgery and anesthesia care. You really can't develop an appropriate pandemic preparedness and response plan without that. And then the third area that I think we all see much more of recently is human migration. And I think in our national level strategic planning, we need to think about that, because many countries are going to find themselves dealing with populations that they maybe did not anticipate. And so what does that mean as you put your plan together? Because if you're not prepared for that and all of a sudden a million people show up in your country, the surgical and anesthesia implications for that are profound. So Emmanuel's absolutely right. Surgery is a very important solution. And as I said, I think when you talk about climate change, pandemic preparedness, and human migration, surgery has a tremendous amount to offer in all three of those areas that are part of our world now.
Thank you very much, John. And thank you, Emmanuel. Thank you to both of you for sharing your expertise and your time with me. Finally, I just want to remind the listeners or encourage them to go to the website, check out the various parts of the book and provide feedback. And it's hoped that your feedback will result in a book which is more accessible for advocating for safe surgery and anesthesia in Africa. So thank you. Thanks, John. Thanks, Emmanuel. Bye-bye.